Last time on Dark Shining Moment.
The experience of almost anybody who looks at Russian influence operations is that first it's like you're not sure you're actually seeing the Russians doing it. And all of a sudden, all these people who had been just pro-Assad boosters do like a 180 and are suddenly experts on Ukrainian fascism.
Crowds of angry citizens took to the streets to seek the overthrow of the pro-Moscow government. On Twitter, the trolls depicted the protesters as an extension of NATO's power.
It was this slow unfolding nightmare, you know, of just watching this happening.
This is Dark Shining Moment, the story of Russia's interference in the U.S. election of 2016, a podcast from Ranieri & Co. I'm Chris Zappone.
But I'm puzzled at the things they tell us that don't fit together, all the pieces of the puzzle.
Barack Obama was about to declare martial law, but strangely, it seemed to be happening only in one county in Texas.
You know, everybody's, you know, all, you know, whipped into a frenzy about, you know, the government, the military is coming in to declare martial law.
Or, if it wasn't martial law, it was an invasion by a foreign power.
This is freaking me out. And I don't know why this isn't getting more play, and it actually makes me a little bit concerned.
Something was afoot. People knew. They just weren't sure what. What happened in 2016 isn't just the story of the mechanics of social media interference. It's the story of a moment. The Kremlin-backed networks that flourished on Twitter also flourished on YouTube and other social media platforms. Social media was just one arm of the tangle of information tools Moscow had slowly amassed and which would change and sharpen to influence the U.S. in that year. These other arms emerged, one on top of each other. But they were only effective if they sat on a bed of alternative news that sowed distrust and weaved itself into the fabric of America's information space. So now I'm recording.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, sure, man. That's cool.
Okay. This is Andy Rosebrook. In the years before Trump's election, he was living in rural Arkansas, south of Little Rock, a town called Pine Bluff. Andy, like a lot of people, kept up with news and current events through podcasts and YouTube.
You know, Arkansas has always been an extremely poor state, but I was lucky enough to grow up in a very stable home. Both of my parents are veterans, and they've been around the world. So that's something that a lot of my friends that I grew up with didn't have, a wider perspective on the world.
Andy enjoyed listening to podcasts as he went night fishing. Night fishing was a big part of his routine. He was a teen when 9/11 happened. Afterwards, a lot of his friends joined the military. Some died fighting overseas. Being the son of veterans himself, in a state that contributed heavily to military enlistment, Andy wanted to know what exactly had his friends enlisted to fight against. Andy read about terrorism, about Osama bin Laden. Then, in the years after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, he read up on the regime of Saddam Hussein.
From like 2007 till 2017 or so, so about 10 straight years, I owned my own business where I did IT management for businesses here in Arkansas. So I made my own hours. So I was really gifted with tons and tons of free time.
He listened nightly.
Well, I'm a weirdo. I've been following authoritarian governments for a long time. I've been fascinated by fascism and Nazi Germany and, you know, how that happened, because, you know, they teach you a lot about that here in schools, but they don't really teach you how that happened. Like, how could all these people who probably were good people, how could they all turn, you know, so evil?
His attention moved from one dictator to another in history. Hitler, Mussolini, Franco, And finally, one of a more modern era, Vladimir Putin. Andy had actually been deep diving on Putin when the Kremlin-funded news network Russia Today was launched in 2005. This is an RT host discussing a CIA report on the use of torture.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The Senate's report on the CIA's extensive use of torture gives new meaning to the term shock and awe.
So for Andy, RT wasn't just another voice of news online. Carrying stories that catered to Americans who had grown skeptical of their own media, especially after the rush to war in Iraq, RT was nevertheless a news source from a country whose politics ran counter to America's. Andy treated it with caution. At night, as Andy fished, he listened to comedians, podcasters, upstart voices that were quickly populating the vast landscape opened up by YouTube and social media. He listened to Joe Rogan. He loved Joe Rogan.
I've been a fan of Joe Rogan since like 1996, like a big fan. I think I listened to his first 1,000 podcasts, which is, it's a lot of devotion to a podcast because, you know, he would do 3-hour podcasts.
Andy listened in 2013 when the young alternative journalist, Abby Martin, who had a show on RT, turned up on Joe Rogan's podcast.
Abby Martin, thank you for coming.
Thank you for inviting me.
I think it was about 2012, 2013, I really noticed he took a strong liking to Russia Today.
And because of you guys, because of this new breed of young kids who grew up with the internet, who grew up with this massive access to information.
This is the first time RT's Abby Martin is on Joe Rogan's show.
Wouldn't it be to have like an independent news source that was funded completely and totally by tax dollars and had nothing to do with any commercials whatsoever?
That's what RT is.
Is that what
Russia,
RT is?
Yeah.
For Russia.
Mm-hmm.
The Russian Times is RT, right?
Russia Today.
Russia Today, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Are they accurate with stuff that goes on in Russia?
That is questionable. They, you know, it's like the BBC in London.
RT like the BBC? Well, not exactly. Initially, RT emulated the kind of informative BBC news-style programming, but without anything like the independence charter the BBC had. This kind of false equivalence is the bread and butter of Russia's information war. Martin was pretty clear about the focus of RT, as she told Rogan.
So you're not going to cover Putin, obviously, like very unfavorably. You're probably not going to call it the elections as being stolen or whatnot. But in terms of RT America, which is where I work, we just focus wholeheartedly on American foreign policy and domestic policy. So, I mean, we don't see Russia going around and colonizing the rest of the world. So I'm kind of picking my battles here.
He had Abby Martin on his podcast probably 4 or 5 times in the next 2 or 3 years after that. And every time, you know, he would refer to her as, a brave journalist. Somebody fighting the powers that be, fighting for the poor people, that kind of stuff, exposing all the lies of the American government.
Rogan hosted Martin. Martin appeared on other YouTube-based shows. Everyone appeared on each other's shows, and part of that everyone was RT. Russian-American media academic Vasily Gatov has watched the evolution of Russia and America's media. He said if RT had any influence, it was through the people-to-people contacts with Americans.
This was one of the inventions of early Russian diplomacy. And if you think deeper, you will understand that this thing of influencing foreign public opinion through informal channels is much closer to this idea than to anything else.
You know, there are a lot of different audiences that cross-pollinated.
You can hear how RT presented itself as, well, just another option in the flourishing world of alternative media. Never mind that it was funded by a government more or less committed to kneecapping the U.S.
Americans' trust in societal institutions is plummeting, especially when it comes to the Fourth Estate. According to a Gallup poll from last year, people actually trust banks more than they do newspapers or TV news in this country. But the distrust of the mainstream has paved the way for a renaissance of alternative media to flourish.
And perhaps there's no better example than the Young Turks, a popular YouTube channel with billions of views.
Well, earlier today, I was joined by the founder, host of the Young Turks, and former MSNBC anchor, Cenk Uygur, to discuss why his media platform is far more successful than the corporate media will ever be.
To be sure, America gave RT a lot of material to work with. The financial crisis, the wrong-headed invasion of Iraq, Abu Ghraib torture, police violence, mass shootings, racism, inequality, American division was everywhere.
I really cannot explain why this division was ignored, or ignored in practical terms, that people who, the campaign managers and so on, they tried kind of to push it aside and act as if nothing is happening. I mean, I've been spending a lot of time both in Russia and America, and I saw this tremendous division that started to grow up in American society since then. And the main peddler of this division was Fox News. This is not Russian interference that created Fox News, but it was Rupert Murdoch who created Fox News.
RT could give just the right nudge here and there. The network didn't invent American division. It just skillfully curated and encouraged it, giving a platform to its more polarizing voices. Abby Martin was even a guest on Piers Morgan's show on CNN.
I mean, are you concerned about other parts of the programming on RT America? I mean, do you believe that although your show may have that kind of independence of voice, that a lot of the other programming doesn't and has drifted in the last week into blatant propaganda?
And here, the pivot to false equivalents. Martin says essentially, what about corporate media? Isn't that the same?
Here's no different than every other corporate media station. I mean, we're talking about six corporations that control 90% of what Americans see, hear, and read. The lead up to the Iraq War, parroting exactly what the establishment said.
RT's rebranded slogan, Question More, contained an implicit message. Question everything. Trust nothing.
But I think that the real question that should be asked is, why do I have to work for RT to tell the truth about corporations and the U.S. government? I mean, seriously, you guys are beholden to advertisers that you cannot criticize. And that's why I work for a station that I can criticize.
Well, hang on.
RT provided a slow acid bath of cynicism, skepticism, and confusion for Americans. An information war is not like a military battle. Rather, it's a long, slow siege. As RT's boss said at the time, it was impossible to make a weapon when the war had already started. For Moscow, the war with the U.S. was already on. It's just that the U.S. didn't know it. Here's another early RT host, around the same time, being interviewed on C-SPAN's Book TV, describing the U.S. media as a tool of the government.
I feel like our mainstream media really is happy to close their eyes to, is really happy to try to blind the eyes of the masses as well, because I feel like they have become this body that works for the government. They're a lapdog of the government instead of a watchdog of the government these days. So somebody's got to do it. And it's embarrassing, I think, for U.S. media if RT is doing a much better job at exposing some of the hypocrisy and the corruption and the wrongdoing that's going on here.
Who owns RT?
RT is publicly funded, so it's funded by the Russian government.
Why do they do it, you know?
You know, you would have to ask them.
Around this time, Russia was helping the Syrian regime fight against rebels during that country's civil war. The Syrian regime was using chemical weapons against its own people. When it came to Syria, certain ideas were spreading. Congressman Thomas Massey on CNN lamented how hard it was to know what was happening on the ground in Syria. He stressed that he'd like to know how the attack happened. Finally, when the host confronted him with the question, "Who do you think is behind the chemical attack?" he replied,
"Frankly, I don't think Assad would have done that. Supposedly, that airstrike was on an ammo dump. I don't know if it was released because there was gas stored in the ammo dump or not. That's plausible. I'm not saying that's what I think happened."
Just questioning more, as it were. The astonishment is audible in the CNN host's voice.
But you're more inclined to believe the position of what Bashar al-Assad is saying and what the Russians are saying right now than believe what even your colleagues here in the United States believe is truth, that this is Assad?
I don't think it would have served Assad's purposes to do a chemical attack on his people.
Now, it's one thing to say, I don't know. It's quite another to say, I don't know, but I'm inclined to accept the word of the autocrat. Here's former Australian diplomat Peter Tesh discussing RT.
They presented ostensible facts, but managed always to nuance and to inflect them with a sense of uncertainty and doubt, and leading the viewer to question whether, in fact, what they were hearing from their own multiple media sources was in any way credible.
Unlike the Bush administration's fabled weapons of mass destruction in 2002, video of dying Syrian civilians was available on YouTube for the world to see. The same YouTube where these voices proliferated. And it's here where Andy began to notice something among these podcasters and YouTubers. Topics the Kremlin was cynical about, these Americans were cynical about. Now, skepticism for evidence about the use of chemical weapons in Syria could be found across alternative media. Here's Dave Rubin of the Rubin Report.
And now there's evidence of it, and let's listen to the human tree, John Kerry, discussing what happened.
The indiscriminate slaughter of civilians, the killing of women and children and innocent bystanders by chemical weapons is a moral obscenity.
All right, that's pretty much the most emotional I've ever seen John Kerry. I don't quite understand the distinction. Somehow it's okay if 100,000 people die by bombs and bullets, but if they cough before they die now, we're suddenly very upset.
It wasn't that these people embraced an official Kremlin line. There often wasn't one. Instead, these voices embraced a certain distrust for what the news outlets were saying. Back in Arkansas, as Andy Rosebrook listened to podcasts, he noticed RT's gathering effect on his favorite shows. He traced it back to just about the time Abby Martin first appeared on Joe Rogan.
I like to say that I didn't go searching any of this out. I mean, all this came straight into my browser and my phone. I didn't have to go looking for any of this stuff. It came to me.
Russia Today had switched from emulating the BBC style to becoming something more akin to Zero Hedge, a website populated by anonymous authors who amplify conspiracy theories about current events. Meanwhile, Andy nightfished and he wondered, why were these podcasters and YouTube voices repeating the Russian view on international events? Andy Rosebrook wasn't the only person who noticed this change.
Well, I'm Russian. Born in Moscow in 1965. Well, I have a very kind of complex family history because one of my grandfathers was, well, to be honest, a Beria henchman.
This is Vasily Gatov. The Beria he mentioned was the dreaded Leventi Beria, the spy boss in Joseph Stalin's time.
Another grandfather of mine was a spy. But professionally, I'm a journalist, educated at Moscow State University. But for almost 35 years, I pursued a career in journalism and media management.
The change that Andy noticed, the one that coincided with RT's hosts appearing on other YouTube shows, and those hosts adopting more pro-Kremlin views, well, Vasily had noticed the change with RT as well.
They started to develop some marginal success when they completely changed the scope of what they were doing. Instead of trying to address people who are, well, genuinely, generally interested in foreign policy or, I don't know, on the left or right, they started just to give voice to people who are extremely polarizing.
Vasily Gatov said that for RT, it didn't matter if the figures were extreme left or extreme right, whether they were Noam Chomsky or Alex Jones. Gatov says there was a kind of learning curve taking place between RT and some of its more high-profile guests. Gatov contends RT learned this polarizing style from Western guests like WikiLeaks chief Julian Assange and lawyer-turned-pundit Glenn Greenwald.
It came with Assange. It really, I'm pretty much sure that this idea had been offered to RT by Assange and Greenwald.
You can get a sense of Assange's style from a speech he gave on the balcony of the Ecuadorian embassy in the UK.
Our beliefs about the world and each other have been created by the same system that has lied us into repeated wars that have killed millions.
What you really see is there's a perception that there's no national religion in the United States. Christianity is not the state religion. That's true. But the national religion in the United States is worship of all things military, and journalists are its high priests.
The fact that this emergence of RT's intramarginal interests coincided with the appearance of Assange and Grünwald on RT is very interesting, kind of overlooked.
Whether this new polarizing style was offered to RT, or RT simply learned it, is unclear. But Gatov wasn't the only person who suggests that RT drew its inspiration, if not some of its power, from the Western-style talking head format it had adopted. Here's Peter Tesh.
In 2016, I had just arrived in Moscow for the second time, on this occasion on a diplomatic posting as Australian ambassador to the Russian Federation.
Tesh knew something about RT.
My observations of Russia today were, if you like, underpinned by the fact that their headquarters was in a very large building immediately over the fence at the rear of my residence. The Russia Today building, it was actually originally constructed for the 1980 Olympics as the Novosti Press Agency building. So it's this enormous spear-like block on the Moscow Ring Road, not far from the Moscow River.
The Speer, Peter mentions, is Albert Speer. That's the architect that Hitler commissioned to design his grandiose Nazi buildings.
A fairly brutalist sort of bit of design. When I got up in the morning and looked out of my kitchen window, I could see all of these satellite dishes. Not all of them were pointed at me. Every time I looked out at Russia Today's building, I had this memory of a different era when it was a different news organization and it was a different Moscow.
Tesh, like Gatov, had seen RT adopting modes of communication it learned from American and Western media, where what was on offer was conflict and controversy.
Russia Today is a much more potent, I think, vehicle for communicating the sense of distrust in anything that sources of authority communicate. The shows that they would present were in many ways indistinguishable from the Jerry Springer-like shows that were dominant in many parts of the US media landscape. Russia Today had been very successful, I think, in recruiting native English speakers to anchor some of these sorts of programs to present their news broadcasts.
Which way the learning curve flowed was not clear, east to west or west to east. In any case, Russia's agenda with RT had become more aggressive. In 2013, Putin articulated the role of RT as trying to, quote, break the Anglo-Saxon monopoly on the global information streams, unquote. Anglo-Saxon is the preferred term for American and British dominance. This was an effort for which Putin believed RT was seeing some success. And a large part of RT's success was how seamlessly its cynicism flowed into the West's alternative media, the upstarts on YouTube and the podcasting world.
Because the video shows that there was a chemical weapon attack. It doesn't show who did it. That's horrible evidence as to who did it and why we should attack the regime.
CNN and Fox News, they've gotten to be what you gotta think of as untrustworthy sources.
You know, only a depraved animal would use chemical weapons to kill someone. How about if they drop one of those bombs we dropped on Japan that doesn't kill women and children? Because we're so much better.
Russia-born journalist Leonid Brzezinski, writing in Bloomberg, would describe RT's effect like this.
The effect, of course, is that the crazies that populate the alternative news sphere, those dismissed by the mainstream, consume pro-Vladimir Putin information with their general diet. Putin is not the main dish Russian propaganda outlets are serving. He's just a spice that goes well with the alternative diet those who eschew mainstream media seek.
This flank of America was completely undefended, completely unprotected. So it was easy to peel people away from more moderate views. Just another fracture in reality. Another little split. When Trump's campaign started, he would speak directly to these audiences. They'd be waiting and receptive. And the Kremlin's views insinuated themselves with the many people who felt increasingly that democracy was not delivering. So it was in America, where Andy was watching and listening. Here's Abby Martin with comedian Duncan Trussell in 2015.
I think it's important to have power structures that are holding each other in check.
Right. You mean like we need a Putin?
In the sense that, like, look at the Syria thing. I mean, there's different things that Putin is actually, like, deterring U.S. hegemony and imperialism.
So how much of this stuff that we hear about Putin is Western propaganda to make us think he's an asshole?
I think he's an asshole.
Okay. But...
So clearly, the message was not pro-Putin. It was that everyone else was just as bad. Peter Tesh again.
I think they saw models that resonated with Western audiences, that generated viewership, and they embraced those, and they have managed to develop those in their own way with a sophistication and an efficacy that I think, for example, China is yet to acquire.
RT was evolving, but other efforts by other entities supporting the Kremlin and targeting the West, they were evolving too. And so it made sense that after watching RT change gears, Gatov noticed something small and irregular just out of the corner of his eye in 2015. It was on Twitter.
I discovered a pattern that was connected with some Russian-related American personalities. When almost every tweet coming from these people were immediately, in seconds, probably even faster, answered by some strange Twitter handles with extremely right-wing opinions. And it was happening in real time in my eyes.
Coming on a decade later, and democracies were familiar with bots on social media and the capacity they have to affect perceptions. But in 2015, the use of this technology was both new and not fully appreciated, factors that would give them power in the public's mind at a decisive moment. The drive from Arkansas, where Andy Rosebrook lives, down towards Central Texas, is 10 hours of highways, overpasses, trucks, and exit signs. Thick, humid air in the summer, and a sun that seems to bleach the sky. In early 2015, something strange was happening in Central Texas. It happened in a town called Bastrop, an unassuming community east of Austin.
There hasn't been much activity in Bastrop since Operation Jade Helm launched, but it has stirred up quite the hysteria on social media.
The U.S. Army had announced plans to run a military exercise for special forces that would take place across Texas and extend into New Mexico, Arizona, and Mississippi. Beginning in July, the troops would practice moving personnel and equipment. The document that outlined these maneuvers was posted online.
Hashtag Jade Helm. I mean, there's days with thousands of tweets.
The controversial military drill was all talk, not a lot of action.
The person who posted it suggested that the operation, called Jade Helm 2015, wasn't actually a regular military exercise. Alex Jones and the people of the alternative news world piled on. They suggested it was a plan by the U.S. federal government, directed by the Obama administration, to impose martial law in these areas. Or to seize their guns. Or worse, it was a plan for a foreign occupation that would take over part of the U.S.
But I'm puzzled at the things they tell us that don't fit together, all the pieces of the puzzle.
Well, you know, everybody's whipped into a frenzy about, you know, the government, the military is coming in to declare martial law. From a strategic standpoint, if you're declaring martial law, you're, like, taking over a country. Why are you starting here?
Jade Helm's coming up. They know which states aren't going to go along, which state leaderships won't go along with martial law. I thought Jade Helm was just a drill at first. I didn't know why they freaked out so bad ahead of time. It's the cover for military occupation of the Southwest.
It went from some
crazy idea that was introduced somewhere online to all of a sudden it's on InfoWars being discussed by Alex Jones and that whole fringe, at the time, very fringe.
And I've been told that by high-level military now. And we found all the documents and did a special report, Jade Helm mystery solved, this last week that's gone viral.
Far-right element of U.S. politics that had not been mainstreamed yet by the Donald Trump political movement, and then very quickly came over into, like, normal society.
Molly McHugh has been watching the evolution of Russia's information warfare strategies since 2008, when she was advising the Georgian government at the time of its war with Russia.
So in less than 90 days, I think it was like 60-some days, you had the idea of this thing, that this military exercise was actually a secret internal opposition crackdown in the United States.
The national news jumped on the action, becoming another layer of amplification and attention. It looked like classic American nuttery, embraced by right-leaning people. The power of conspiracy theory to galvanize, to articulate a grievance, was so seductive, politicians would lean into it. Here is U.S. Senator Ted Cruz from Texas offering his views on Jade Helm.
You know, I understand the concern that's been raised by a lot of citizens about Jade Helm. My office, we've reached out to the Pentagon to inquire about this exercise. We're assured that it is a military training exercise. And I have no reason to doubt those assurances, but I understand the reason for concern and uncertainty.
The headline on RT, Jade Helm 15, One Nation Under Siege. The Texas governor ordered the Texas State Guard to monitor the U.S. Army troops doing the maneuvers. The U.S. military was reassuring the local community that everything was normal. But in the psychology of conspiracy, the U.S. military would say that, wouldn't they?
Some poor, I think, colonel-ranked military schlep shows up in some small town in Texas to have a town hall meeting about what the local military exercise was going to mean for people in the town, aka there will be, you know, Humvees and stuff driving around, don't be alarmed. He thinks he's going to have this kind of chat, and the town hall is packed with, like, angry villagers with literal pitchforks and torches who are like, how can you stand by while the President of the United States rounds up the opposition? He's just like, what the fuck is happening here?
To get exposure to new terrain, new airfields, and just add a new level of experience before they go into combat.
The lady right beside you there, Blake, but let me ask a couple of these from downstairs. Will any of this exercise have anything to do with Agenda 21?
I'm not familiar with what Agenda 21 is.
Good.
Agenda 21 is a UN-sponsored initiative designed to foster sustainable development. It has nothing to do with militaries or troops.
This is freaking me out, and I don't know why this isn't getting more play, and it actually makes me a little bit concerned.
It turns out that the trolls of the St. Petersburg-based Internet Research Agency were watching the news, too. They had used bots to amplify the fears that the U.S. government would use Jade Helm as a cover for some sort of takeover. Andrew Weisbird had seen Kremlin-linked botnets pivot towards Jade Helm. Weisbird wrote at the time,
at Jade Helm 15 Intel is the account in question. It appeared in April and managed to insinuate itself in social networks of Americans concerned with Jade Helm 15. We noticed almost immediately that at Jade Helm 15 Intel owed almost all of their 20,000-plus followers to Twitter botnets previously seen operating in support of Kremlin information operations.
Conspiracy theorists and worried Texans pointed to a map that was generated by the U.S. Army. It showed how, for the purposes of the exercise, some states were deemed enemy, some were deemed friendly. The map existed, the exercise was real, but it was the meaning of the event that the Russian trolls would mess with. The Russian trolls could see and learn in real time what was possible to project at a distance to Americans. Just like how the trolls in episode 1 would establish relationships with people on social media to influence political matters where those people lived.
To the extent that the governor of Texas mobilizes the Texas State Guard, so sort of the local Texas militia that is not the National Guard, to observe the U.S. military exercise that's happening in Texas, which is just bananas. This whole thing is bananas. Like, just in case they're going to start arresting people. And it was that mobilization of energy. So it wasn't just people believed a crazy idea. It was that you went from introduction of idea to mobilization of American subjects to confront military authority in Texas, where, like, normally the military is like rah, rah, hoo ha.
Mobilization. Remember that word. Back in Arkansas, Andy was also picking up on a particular online energy. The cynical commentary that seemed to always side against the U.S. was on YouTube, on Facebook, on Twitter. Where the videos of the alternative media sources were shared, they were now attracting tons of attention, comments, likes.
If you scroll down, you would see that the top comments in the comment section had thousands of likes. Like thousands of likes within hours. I guess you would call that the troll farms in action. You'd find a video defending Putin and, you know, he would have like thousands of likes on the top comments. Just, you know, ridiculous amounts. And, you know, that kind of stuff boosted their videos to the top of the search results and the top of the recommended lists. It was the wild, wild west when it comes to all these troll farms on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube especially. But yeah, I'll never forget it because I lived through it.
Just as there was a learning curve for RT and how it approached democracies, there was a learning curve for the Internet Research Agency and other pro-Kremlin troll networks. They could see how they could boost content online with selective support of comments on social media. They learned how a topic like Jade Helm 15 could be co-opted, then manipulated for effect.
And I think that was a really great test case for the Russians of how easy it is to, if you find the right trigger point, the thing that exploits sort of local tensions, local beliefs, local unhappiness, specific personality politics that related to President Obama and how he had been sort of demonized by the right wing for the years of his presidency, that you can have these really powerful social effects. And for them, it would have been a huge green light to just go, go, go in terms of driving Americans crazy in the 2016 election.
Next time on Dark Shining Moment.
Vladimir Putin and his top five advisors were having an internal debate in the Kremlin about releasing Hillary Clinton's, at that time it was written, 20,000 emails.
So finally we're dedicating huge amounts of resources to manipulating elections in America, and we're managing to push huge amounts of change and make profit off of it.
Dark Shining Moment is a Runnierian co-production, reported and written by me, Chris Sapun. Sound designed by Martin Peralta, executive producer Greg Mueller, consulting producer Richard Baker, and managing producer Nick Randall.